From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There were a lot of politicos who got it wrong last night. One of the worst was Republican gadfly Dick Morris, who was predicting a landslide for Mitt Romney. This morning, he's explaining himself by saying he hadn't taken into account the country's changing demographics, what he called the new America. What he means is the growing number of single women and minorities and voters under 30. The voter base is shifting, and there are those urging the Republican Party to adapt. But in Utah, it's hard to tell whether much is changing. If you're a Democrat, beyond the presidency and a few close calls, there was precious little to cheer about last night. Today in the program, we're talking about just what did happen last night. We'll explore the Utah races, the effect of the national race on the state, and of course, talk about the impact of the Mormon moment. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So today in the program, we're offering some final thoughts on this year's election. We're going to be talking about just what happened last night. There were a few close races here in Utah, of course. Hard to say there were that many surprises in the state, but we'll talk about it. Observers are saying there's a demographic shift going on in the national political landscape. So we'll ask, is anything really changing here in Utah? Also, of course, we'll talk about how Mitt Romney's candidacy influenced the outcome in Utah last night and explore how the question of his religion played out, if it did. We're also talking about what happens now to the so-called Mormon moment. We invite you to join us with your own reflections, questions, comments about what happened last night. 801-585-WEST is our number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program is Kirk Jowers, director, of course, of the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. A longtime supporter of Mitt Romney, serves as chair of Romney's five leadership PACs, and he's joining us in Boston by phone. And Kirk, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks, Doug. It's the morning after.
It sure is. Let me ask you, I'm wondering, was the Romney team genuinely surprised by last night's outcome? I mean, do you think they saw this coming in some way?
No. Everyone was very optimistic going into the convention hall and the different meetings and lunches. People were quite optimistic. Obviously, we all knew in the back of our minds that Ohio hadn't been going as well as we had hoped. Virginia was a little troublesome. Yeah. But it felt like, you know, and you believe what you experience, but these last rallies for Romney had been just overwhelmingly powerful. I was up in New Hampshire in Manchester for that 11 p.m. rally, and it was powerful, the best I've ever seen with Mitt. So you start believing. So there was some nervousness about Virginia and Ohio, but I think no one, even the most pessimistic of us, thought that it would be what it is today, which were, you know, that he was really only able to take back Indiana and North Carolina of those states that Obama won against McCain.
Yeah. Well, I want to get to some particulars as we go, but let me ask you sort of broadly, how are you explaining what happened? I mean, it seems like there were so many different factors at play. There were, you know, circumstance like Hurricane Sandy. Some people are talking about that. People are talking about, you know, a weak ground game that they may have had. And, of course, there's Hispanic voters and the gender gap. I mean, what do you think rises to the top of all of those factors?
Well, I've spent a lot of hours thinking about that, and I kind of put them into two brackets. One is the long-term, the kind of long-term issues for the Republican Party, and that is that Republicans have been driving themselves off of a demographic cliff in some ways. Their failure to really address immigration and to really connect with Hispanics has taken us from, you know, 44% that Bush was able to get with Hispanics, and down to this, you know, kind of ridiculously low level for Romney has to be a wake up call. McCain should have been a wake up call. The inability to really attract young people, even though oftentimes, and this applies to Hispanics as well, that they like, in many cases, Republican ideas on the economy and jobs and deficit more than Democrats, but because of sometimes harsh rhetoric, sometimes difficult policy choices, and, you know, on and on, just not, the Republicans just aren't connected with Hispanics and young people. So that's something that should have been addressed after McCain. It needs to be addressed going forward, or Republicans are really in trouble because the demographics just keep getting away from them. On the short term for this race, you're right, there's so many things. Obviously, you give credit to the winner, Obama, and his team, and the ground game they had was fantastic. Things that no one had any control over. The storm certainly wasn't ideal for Romney. Stunted his momentum. Gave Obama a chance for a strong closing argument. A couple of Neanderthals in the Republican Party talking about women and rape didn't help the gender gap. That is another one of those long-term issues for Republicans. So it kind of goes on and on and on.
Hmm.
But
one of the questions gets at what you were talking about earlier. And one of the questions is whether the governor had gone too far right during the Republican primary to really get back to the center. Is the Romney campaign, are they talking about that at all, rethinking whether or not they had maybe gone too far?
Those discussions certainly haven't happened yet, and who knows if they will at this point. They will. I mean, there will be the licking of the wounds and talking about what could have been. I think clearly immigration was a real missed opportunity. That could have changed things. And Romney, that was something that he had in his control to really change those dynamics. On the gender issue, I feel worse for Romney because that seems out of his control. He was doing very well with women, and then Santorum said some things from the 1950s, and that took down the Republican brand and took a little piece out of Romney, and Romney built it back up. And you had Aiken, you know, from circa 1300s talking about rape and women. And that took a real toll on Romney and the Republican brand. And then, of course, we had that great headline that one poll, I think it was Gallup or Pew, said, you know, Romney reaches gender equity or equality or something, gender parity. And then the very next day you have Murdoch go to, you know, the 1100s with his comment, and again Mitt just lost like 10 points with women overnight with that. Those weren't his comments. He certainly is nowhere near them on any of those issues, but it's a huge brand problem.
How do you assess the governor's choice for vice president? What do you think? Paul Ryan, and there was a lot of talk about different kinds of candidates. Some talk now, certainly since Ohio turned out to be so crucial, that Rob Portman should have been the choice. What are you thinking about all of that now?
My first choice since 2005 was Condoleezza Rice. I really feel like, you know, obviously substance matters the most, but sometimes images matter too. And someone like Condoleezza Rice would have at least, you know, for these undecided voters who don't really look into the policies, but they, you know, you look at the focus groups and they really look at images. I think she would have been a real important addition to the ticket. Also with foreign policy would have been helpful.
But Kirk, she couldn't have gotten past the question of abortion rights. She's pro-choice.
Right, and I think the Republicans are going to, and you're exactly right, that was the deal killer. You know, McCain wanted to go with Joe Lieberman, which would have been a real, again, another big images thing. To pick the former vice president for Al Gore as his would have maybe given him a small chance against Obama, but again, the Right to Life folks kind of vetoed that, and that was, I think, the same with Condoleezza Rice as a possibility. Republicans are going to have to figure out how big of a tent they want to have and where they're going to allow people to share most of the common principles, but not all of them, and that's probably one.
I know there was some question. But, no, go ahead.
No, I just think I didn't completely answer your question. As to Paul Ryan,
Yeah,
it turned out to be less of a factor. I was nervous about him, partly because his budget, it gave a lot of nice strongholds for them to grab onto and use against the ticket. And they really didn't do that very much. They really kept it focused on Mitt Romney. And so I'm very much looking forward to some of the books that go into Axelrod and the rest of Obama's teams on why they decided to just focus so heavily on what I think was a caricature of Romney, but be that as may, focus on Romney instead of using Ryan against the ticket. They did that a little bit the first week, and then they just pretty much ignored him, as did the media.
Yeah.
So he probably gets no credit and not as much blame.
Right. I know there was some question, and this was a big question, of whether Mitt Romney was really likable enough. Do you think after the first debate performance, he passed over that? Did he get that settled, do you think?
I think he did. I mean, you know, it's unheard of to watch the Pew polls do a 12-point swing in someone's favor, and that's what he did after that first debate. He had been defined by hundreds of millions of dollars of negative ads, and, you know, that's certainly one of those Monday morning quarterbacks of should Romney's, you know, not have kept such a big war chest in September. Did they need to go out? But, you know, and that's where the storm makes it difficult as well, because Obama came in and he's our commander in chief and he handles the storm, and Chris Christie had his love affair with him. And, and you look at the polls and people appreciated the way Obama handled it. And they thought, and his leadership switched, I think, 11 points versus Romney. Romney was up by 6, and after it, he was down by 5. So, you know, those factors are big as people walk into that voting booth.
Yeah. We're going to shift gears a little bit later here in the program to focus on Utah races, so I wanted to get your perspective. What do you think was the influence of Mitt Romney on Utah races? Were you surprised by Jim Matheson surviving and Ben McAdams winning?
I was surprised, not because I know Jim is probably the best campaigner in Utah and beloved here, but it seemed to me just too much to overcome to have, you know, to have to beat your standard bearer, to beat Obama by 25, 26 points, 2/3 new constituents, so he didn't have that history of good service and relationships to fall back on, kind of the historic nature of Mia Love and some of the great advantages she had of speaking prime time at the Republican National Convention and being so incredibly well-funded and outside groups. It seemed too much to ask even of Jim Matheson to overcome that. And the fact that he did is really pretty jaw-dropping.
Let me ask you, how is...
And the same would go to Ben, a lot of credit to Ben McAdams as well. I mean, to overcome a presidential candidate who gets, you know, 73% or so in Utah, that's not easy, especially in a state that allows straight ticket voting.
Right. Kirk Jowers, director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, the University of Utah, longtime supporter of Mitt Romney, joined us from Boston. Kirk, thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug. It was good to be on.
We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radioWEST@KUER.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're offering some final thoughts on this year's election, talking about what happened last night, particularly exploring what happened here in Utah. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let me introduce the panel we have with us today. Quinn Monson is joining us, an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Brigham Young University. Serves as director for the university's Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy. He's with us from the studios of KBYU in Provo. And Quinn, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Gerke is with us, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert, welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
Holly Richardson is with us, writes the conservative blog Holly on the Hill, also a former Utah House representative. And Holly, welcome.
Thank you.
And Jim DeBacchus is with us. He's chair of the Utah Democratic Party. And we should mention, last night he put himself forward to fill the Utah Senate seat being vacated by Ben McAdams, who, of course, won that victory in the Salt Lake County mayoral race. So, Jim DeBacchus, welcome.
Always a pleasure, Doug.
So I want to start. We're going to get to the state races, but because Mitt Romney's candidacy seemed to have some influence here, let's start with that. What influence do you think, and Quinn Monson, I'll put this to you first, what influence do you figure Mitt Romney had on the races here in Utah?
Well, he had a lot less influence than I thought he would. It's amazing to me that we have Jim Matheson and Ben McAdams getting elected in Salt Lake County with what everyone thought would be a Romney Tusami on the, you know, on the ballot. And I think what may have happened a little bit is that Utah voters, and particularly Mormon voters who were anticipating being a part of history, might have seen the writing on the wall a day or two ahead of time, and a few of them, at least enough of them, didn't end up voting. I don't think our turnout figures are going to knock anyone's socks off the way that people thought they might. And in the end, we had an electorate that looked a lot like we've seen in recent elections.
What was it, like 75%, I think it was, something like that?
Yeah, I don't think it was way above in terms of a percent of registered voters. I don't think it was way above what we've seen in recent years. And so in those circumstances, you've got two really good Democratic candidates who cross over and appeal to Republicans, and you see a lot of people voting for Mitt Romney and then voting for Jim Matheson or Ben McAdams, so that didn't really end the way that people feared it might.
Mm. Robert, what do you think? I mean, it's interesting that I guess people were thinking that there was going to be 80-85% turnout.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to note that Mitt Romney didn't get as many votes as Ronald Reagan got in 1984.
Well, and even more than that, I think, you know, statewide, as Kirk mentioned, Governor Romney got about 73%,
yeah.
I think.
Which is pretty good.
Which is pretty good. It's no slouch. But if you break it down and look at what he did in Salt Lake County, he actually got 16,000 fewer votes than George Bush did in 2004. So in terms of the coattail effect in Salt Lake County, it was pretty negligible, I think. And that created an opening where Jim Matheson and Ben McAdams can all they have to do then is chip off, you know, a smaller portion, yeah, of crossover votes, and they can actually win this thing statewide. The vote total was 50,000 more than George Bush got, and I don't know exactly how to explain that right now.
Right.
Maybe Quinn has a better idea, but you have this effect where 70,000 more people outside of Salt Lake County voted for Mitt Romney, but in that Salt Lake County where the bulk of the population is in the 4th District and obviously all of the population in the Salt Lake County mayor's race, he didn't perform that well. 57-58% was the total, which, you know, again, you'd have to be pretty happy about that if you're running for office, but
yeah,
if you're trying to create a coattail effect or a tsunami effect, as it was billed, it just doesn't get the job done.
Well, Jim DeBacchus, you must have been bracing for that tsunami, and when it sort of came, but it didn't exactly. Were you surprised by that?
We were bracing. You know, we spent the issue that may not have quite gone through the process here with everybody is just how hard Jim and Ben and the Democratic Party and have been working, and we tried to keep it low key, but we had full-time staff since June. We had 30 full-time people. We mailed out 1,500,000 pieces of mail to independent and wavering Republicans, and we were trying to stay under the radar. We didn't want to stir up the mighty hornet and the tsunami, but I think we worked and worked and worked and worked, and those 2,700 votes eventually ended up paying off. Also, our LDS Dems, I think the effect that they had, they made on the order of 25 or 30,000 calls within the LDS Dems. They were talking to peers, and in a close race like this, especially where 71% of the electorate is LDS, I think that kind of effect has an effect.
Holly, I want to get to you, but let me just ask Quinn something because this has come to mind. And this, I guess there was some – I kind of figured, Quinn Monson, that Democrats who are also Mormon would take the opportunity for what they would have perceived as this kind of historic opportunity to kind of cross over at least this one time to vote for Mitt Romney. It doesn't seem like that really happened.
It didn't happen very much. It happened just a little bit. So we had some national data from a firm called YouGov, a sample of nearly 1,500 Mormons nationally that was passed along to us just a day or two before the election. And we looked at that sample. And what you see is, and in our own Utah data, is that Mormon Democrats viewed Mitt Romney more favorably than they might have viewed another Democratic or another Republican candidate, but it didn't outweigh their partisanship. In other words, we thought there might be this sort of tribal element that Mormons were anxious to be a part of this historic moment, yeah. And that even Mormon Democrats would cross over, but not so much. It turns out that only about 15% of Mormon Democrats voted for Mitt Romney, and that's a lot lower than the 30 or 40% that I thought was possible. And I think that helped avoid the larger margin that you might have seen in Salt Lake County and elsewhere in Utah even, so that Mitt Romney looks not too different from John McCain or Ronald Reagan in terms of how he did in this state.
Hmm. Holly, how are you thinking about this?
Well, I think it's great that Quinn's on the program because he's the only one who had accurate polling.
Yeah. We'll get to that.
So, yeah, sorry, but true.
Holly.
It's true. And I want to sit down with you and figure out how you were doing your polling because you have had a really good track record over the last 4 years that I've been paying attention to your polls. But I've heard people on the national level when we're talking about the Romney race say, look, all these polls can't be wrong. Obama's going to win. You've got all these polls. You've got the shift, you know, and maybe there's this possibility, but it's such an outlier, right? Well, the reverse would be true in the 4th congressional race, right? The polls, except for Quinn's had it tied, and then Jim Matheson's own internals that he released would be maybe the one outlier. Everybody else had the momentum Mia's way, had her up 5 to 6 points, had Matheson under 50%, and in fact, he won without hitting the 50% mark. And so, I mean, that was the one that really surprised me. Yes, I knew the Democrats were working, but so was Mia. And this is a Republican candidate, I think, for that seat that we haven't seen as Republicans for quite a long time. She nationalized the race. She had national eyes, national money, earned media, and she had a ground game. I was part of the ground game. I volunteered in her center. My family made 21,000 phone calls for her.
Wow.
And then I participated in other ways as well. And you know, we were out there working and she was knocking doors and her team was knocking doors. And gosh, you know, what a heartbreaker for that one.
So what happened, do you think?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know, you know, and I think part of it is Jim. I mean, kudos to him, really, truly, because
let me
the
cut
fact
in,
that he's
–
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say in terms of what happened, there are two things that very clearly jump out in the data that we've been able to look at in terms of the exit poll. Number one, when you look at the numbers by party, he actually didn't do as well among Republicans as he normally does. Mm-hmm. He's down in the about a quarter of Republicans, which would put it almost out of reach for him. But when you look at the one thing that Jim DeBacca said earlier that struck me as you look at the data is that Matheson cleaned up in the early voting. Mm-hmm. So I think when we get the numbers from Salt Lake County and other places that break it down by absentee and early, if we can get results by those two, what you'll notice is that the race is close on Election Day. It's very close among absentee voters. But Matheson is clearly outpaced Love on early voting. And so I don't know if there was something in that campaign that was emphasizing early voting or if Democrats just like it more or what. But there's something going on there.
We sent out about 80,000 pieces again to Democrats. We had pictures of Kennedy. There was a lot of internal debate because we had a picture of Obama. And we just don't think that's useful, or at least there are those that don't think that's useful. But we sent those out, and one after another, and maybe that got them out. I don't know. But I do want to say I thought Mia was a tremendous candidate. And despite everything that happened, I mean, when you take someone like Mia Love or anybody and put them under that kind of scrutiny, mm-hmm. with that kind of spotlight, with this kind of negative advertising, mm-hmm. I mean, she's a remarkable woman, and I suspect she will be around doing something else.
Yeah, I think so, too. And, you know, I mean, I know from the Republican side that they targeted early voting. They did. I mean, it's one of the trademarks, I think, of Thomas Wright and what his effort has been is to get early voting and vote by mail. Well, yeah, but chair of the Republican Party, yeah. and then consulting with the Love campaign, yeah. because she's been, in my opinion, the first serious candidate, and I'm ready for the hate mail, I know, first serious candidate that we've had for a long time in that race, as far as being able to really generate the kind of ground game and enthusiasm and money to be competitive with Jim Matheson. So it was really, I mean, that one was the heartbreaker. I could see the Romney one being really iffy, and that one was over early. But I really believed Mia was going to pull it out. And, you know, kudos to Jim and his team for proving me wrong.
Well, Robert Gerke, let me talk about Jim and his team, because I guess, you know, I think it's hard to measure this sort of thing, except for in an election. But you are seeing a much more vibrant, more energetic Democratic Party. I hate to talk to you about you in front of you. Jim DeBacchus, but you
I
are
disagree.
Seeing,
that's DeBacchus.
You are seeing that, right? I mean, do you think that is having an effect, that the Democrats are more engaged than they have been?
Well, I think it's fair to say that they weathered what could have been an absolute cataclysm for yeah. the party. I mean, they go through these cycles, and Jim knows this as well as anybody. They build up and they chip away at this Republican majority, and then redistricting hits, or you get a wave election like you had in 2010, and a lot of those pieces they put in place for a foundation kind of get wiped away. This could have been one of those elections that wiped away those pieces. But I think with the McAdams win, with Jim holding on to this and basically breaking even, they won a House seat, lost a House seat, and lost a Senate seat. So they did okay in the state legislature. I think they probably have a foundation that they can start building on over the next 10 years or so. And you know, you've got in Matheson, in McAdams, in Caroon, you have some viable statewide candidates too.
So what, Quinn Monson, what did we learn about Utah? I mean, there's this question that arguable question about whether or not Republicans nationally are adapting to this changing, shifting demographic in the country. You know, and the, I guess the same question could come up in Utah: is the demographic shifting or changing? Younger voters that may be more apt to vote for a Democrat than in the past, or Hispanic voters for that matter, or you know, are we learning anything about Utah from last night?
I thought Kirk Jowers' comments about immigration and the related, you know, discussion you had there were just spot on. He was very lucid there in a morning after a tough election. And I think it's an odd way to think about this, but I think what's going on nationally with Republicans and their difficulty in attracting essentially non-white voters and younger voters, but I think the non-white, the Hispanic population in particular, and the issue of immigration should be a canary in the coal mine for Utah Republicans. Utah Republicans have such a numerical advantage that they can essentially ignore those warnings, but I think they ignore them at their peril in the long run. The Hispanic population in the state has grown tremendously in the past 15 to 20 to 30 years. It's going to grow some more. A lot of those folks are not registered to vote. Some of them aren't eligible. But their children are. Their children will be eligible, and at some point, Jim and the state party will have the resources to do a massive voter registration and mobilization drive. And if they target it in the right areas of the state, they're going to start winning some state legislative seats, and they're going to build a bench of candidates that can move up and run and challenge for statewide and other federal offices. I mean, it's. What I like about what Jim does with the State Democratic Party is that he sees the long view, and he seems to be building for the long view. And it's really a long-term project. They're so far behind that it's a 10 to to 20-year project to fix the brand name and to attract the coalition of voters that they need to start winning more races.
I think if I could on the Latino vote issue, Pam Perlick here at the university has looked at some really interesting demographic work. And if I'm remembering it right, in about 30 years, Utah is going to be a majority minority state, which is pretty astounding change over that period of time. And I think I think Utah Republicans have probably recognized this more than, say, their counterparts in Arizona, where it should be a little bit more obvious to them, but they haven't really responded the way that one would expect them to do that. I think Utah Republicans recognize that there is going to be this demographic shift in the state, and if they want to maintain their majority or their supermajority in the state, they can't be insensitive or alienate those communities that are going to be growing the most.
Ironically, the LDS Church's statements on immigration and their efforts to get people out to the caucuses earlier this year are having a moderating influence on the state Republican Party and may actually, ironically, help it preserve its majority status in the long run. That's the irony.
Holly, what do you think?
Well, it's interesting. I think we might have hit the high watermark for Republicans in the state. I mean, it's overwhelming at this point. I think it's 24 senators now, mm-hmm. out of 29.
And we only have five.
Yeah, I've got this.
And I think we have 60 House seats out of 75. I think we've hit the high watermark. And I think as we have more of a moderating voice, Republicans in Utah, I mean, I think we saw this over the last couple of years. We're center right, not far right. And so even people like
you mean
me,
rank and file Utahns, right?
Yeah, rank and file. Yeah. And even among the legislature, right? So we had the voices that were out there pretty far to the right. And I consider myself very conservative. And yet I was one that was tarred and feathered because of my immigration vote, which happened to be, normal, I think, you know, one that was a smart vote because we're looking at the reality of the situation, right? And I'm a mom and I have kids and I have kids internationally and so I looked at it from a standpoint of reality, right? And reality is not negotiable.
but, you know, the question comes up, though, too. And I have to say this is a national question, too. And you're going to be hearing a lot of it. So I'll just put it to you in terms of Utah. You know, the conservative wing is going to argue Romney lost because he wasn't bold enough to, you know, express a real conservative ideology and vision. He equivocated too much. Moderates are saying, look, the party's not adapting to these demographic numbers. What do you think is the reality?
Yeah, here? I mean, I think it's – I think you've got to be careful. I mean, some of the stuff that I'm seeing, you know, the morning after with the very conservative circles that I'm, you know, party to is exactly what you're saying. Romney wasn't conservative enough. He was too far in the middle.
Yep.
And yet the reality is we've got this demographic shift. And I saw a thing from Dick Morris. I'm on his email list. You should all be if you're not. And he
said –
who
was spectacularly wrong.
But this is what he said. And I, you know, I believe that he is correct in this assumption. We did not think – we as Republicans did not think that we were going to have higher turnout in these minority bases that went out and voted for Obama. We did not think we would have an increase in the level, you know, the D+7, D+9, whatever it was. It was D+7 last time. We didn't think it was going to go up, right? But it did. It went up in the Black community. It went up in the Hispanic community. It went up in the young voters, right? That is a spectacular fail on the Republican Party's part. It is. And I think Quinn is absolutely right. This is a canary in the mine. And if we do not pay attention, we'll lose our party.
Jim DeBacchus, what have you learned about the state, about the way people behave and think and maybe changing through all of this?
You know, I remember being in Chicago at a meeting about the election. Chicago was the headquarters for the Obama reelection, and there's a lot of people around the table, and they don't check in with Utah very much. But there was a moment where John Huntsman was in, and the room kind of came to a close when they said, tell us about Huntsman. Hmm. And it became evident, I think, that the OFA was more concerned about John Huntsman than anybody else. And if John Huntsman would have been the nominee, or Governor Mitt Romney would have been the nominee, we would have lost by 10 or 15 points. You know, if Mitt Romney, my guess is, and I don't know.
You mean his
Kurt
previous incarnation as a moderate? Yeah.
You know, if the real Mitt Romney, and it would be fun to talk to Mr. Jowers, Dr. Jowers about sometime to see what he, what's deep down in there. But if the real Governor Romney, that moderate who had been governor, had been the presidential candidate, if he would have been able to get through that debate process of the Republicans with those intact views, there is no way Barack Obama would have won last night. But he was pushed so far off, he could not make that return back to pick up those undecided independent voters in virtually every swing state. So it'll be interesting to see how the Republican intelligentsia interprets all this, and that's basically what we've been talking about.
Well, here's one.
Well, no, where? Maybe Robert. You know, what's really interesting is I really believe in the conservative principles espoused by the Republican Party. I do. I believe in self-sufficiency for the most part. I believe in getting government out of the way. I think it's one reason the state is doing well, why our unemployment rate is down, because we try and keep government as much as possible out of people's way. And yet, even within our own state, we have stupid laws like hair braiding has to have a license, right? So... So we certainly have inconsistencies and hypocrisy amongst legislators. And, you know, you try not to have that happen, but it does. And yet at the same time, I don't think it's a sellout to say we need to look at what we're missing here. And you know, do we want to become the party of yesteryear? Well, certainly that was something that Barack Obama was able to push successfully. I don't believe that so. I'm a woman and I'm conservative and I'm pro-life. Right. And I'm pro get government out of the way, pro small business. Let people try. Let them fail. I'm all of that. But I feel like I'm in a shrinking majority. People tell me all the time, how can you be an intelligent woman and be Republican? Well, I don't think that's an oxymoron. Right. But more and more people view it that way. So I think the Republican Party as a brand, certainly nationally, has got to address that. And within the state, we have to be able to sell how we're not this good old boys club, right? And we still in the state face gender issues, right? The Democrats in the state do a much better job of having women run as candidates than Republicans do. And when women do run, they're attacked in ways that men are not, right? Why aren't you home with your babies? Well, I feel like I have a difference that I can make. You know, I have a voice I can share. Well, you don't have a right to run, right? Well, sure we do, right? But I think we face that more than we should.
Holly Richardson is with us. She writes the conservative blog Holly on the Hill. She's joining us here in the studio along with Jim DeBacchus, chair of the Utah Democratic Party. We have Robert Gerke with us, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. And Quinn Monson is joining us, director for the Center of the Study of Elections and Democracy at Brigham Young University. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the 2012 election, giving some final words, talking about what happened last night. Quinn Monson, the director of the Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy at Brigham Young University, is with us. Robert Gerke, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, here in the studio. Holly Richardson blogs at Holly on the Hill. Jim DeBacchus is the chair of the Utah Democratic Party. So, Robert Gerke, I hate to do this to you, but let's talk a little bit about polling. Right. Of course, the Salt Lake Tribune Mason-Dixon poll was I mentioned Dick Morris being spectacularly wrong. So yep. Was that. And yep. Here's a tweet you wrote. Scoring at home, our Mason-Dixon poll was off by 19 points in the Salt Lake County mayor's race, ouch. 12 in the 4th district. Like a monkey threw poo at a wall.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty blunt. I think our polling in this race was a disgrace and a travesty. And I think, you know, we owe the candidates and we owe voters and we owe our readers an apology for it because it was shameful. You know, we rely on the people we contract with to give us some, you know, something that's within the realm of reality. But the numbers they gave us were just sloppy and half-baked, and you know, it was wrong. And we asked questions about it, and they weren't necessarily forthcoming with the answers. And I think we need to look in a different direction to find a new pollster. I'm greatly relieved, I think, that the numbers probably didn't affect the outcome of any of the races. It may have affected the margins, and that's unfortunate too. As journalists and reporters and news outlets, we try not to become part of the news, and unfortunately, that's what we did in this case. And, you know, I do think that given the unfortunate circumstances we kind of found ourselves in over the weekend and on Monday morning, it's highly, highly unusual for us to run the type of story we did on Tuesday where we retracted the results and published new results that also, for the record, were 9 points off in the mayor's race and 8 points off, I believe, in the Matheson race. Those were the adjusted results. But we tried to do the best we could with it, and I hope that we mitigated some of the damage that was done by that sloppiness and shoddy work that we received.
Holly, what sort of damage do you think was done?
You know, I'm not sure that there was damage done to the campaigns. I mean, every candidate feels like they should work as if they're 10 points down, right? I hope that that was the case with all of the candidates, even if it showed that they were up. But certainly, Robert is a friend of mine, but it played into the narrative that the media is in the tank for liberal candidates, right? Because it adjusted in favor of both Democrats. So I know there was a little bit of that narrative out there and just saying, look, you've got the Tribune. They've endorsed Obama. Did you endorse in the county mayor's race?
Yes, we endorsed Ben.
Endorsed Ben. And so then when you say, okay, you went from 10 points up to a dead heat, well, you know, does that fit the narrative of we don't want to be wrong in the race where we endorsed? And, you know, so it's really egg on the Tribune's face, but not Robert's. So he's all good. But
Jim, what do you think?
Holly, our candidates all act like they're 10 points behind.
Well, they usually are.
That's my point. Exactly.
Sometimes they're 35 points behind
that's
or more.
That's the way they work. You know, I want to say something in defense of the Trib. Look, they contracted out. And of course, in the big picture, they have responsibility for a bad subcontractor. But they did what you would expect a serious media organization to do.
I agree.
When they found out it was total baloney, they bit the bullet. There's a lot of media outlets in this town and across the country that would have stood by their story no matter what. And I was calling the Trib, and I was kind of – I thought I was working the ref, you know, that it was going to stand.
Yeah.
But obviously, it wasn't only me. There were serious people that looked, and I give them a great deal of credit for coming back and saying, look, we think we screwed this up. What else can you expect? Media organizations make mistakes as well as
I think
parties.
They did do a great job with that, and I actually had to do that on my blog, and I'm just a little blogger. I get that. But I did, you know, fall victim to a fake email and retracted it and did it publicly on – you know, and then I used colorful language that I didn't know was colorful, and I had to apologize for that as well.
Quinn, I want to hear you on this.
Yeah, the story on in the Tribune retracting the results had the right tone, and I almost wanted to reach out and give Robert a hug just now, but I can't. So we'll save it for later, Robert. But
look forward to it.
But you know, if you go back and read that story carefully, what's amazing to me is that the pollster himself at the end of the story kind of doubles down and says, oh, but maybe we're accurate. So, you know, he wasn't quite sure. Even after they retracted, he I don't think he necessarily was that happy about it. But, you know, the other thing I wanted to point out is it's hard to say what the effect was on voters. I think some of those effects are unconscious, that voters don't even know that they're being affected in terms of their turnout decision and their actual vote decision. But it is a lot easier to pin down effects on the campaigns, particularly in terms of fundraising. Mm-hmm. When you've got donations that have been promised that are intended to fund your last-minute GOTV efforts and those donors disappear because you presumably are 10 points down or whatever, then that is a real effect. And I think in this case, thankfully, it probably didn't affect the outcome, and so the recriminations won't be quite as difficult to deal with.
Yeah, I wanted to ask more broadly about polling because it seems like it was a story. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you had suspicious conservatives, suspicious of the numbers that were coming out. Nate Silver, for example, his 538 blog on the New York Times website. He's gotten a lot of attention and took a lot of heat. And if you go back and look at it now, he pretty much nailed it.
And exactly. And, I want to just pipe up from a candidate's perspective and a campaign perspective is you've got to be able to trust your pollster. I don't want to be on a campaign where I'm getting shoddy feedback. If I've lost the race, I want to know it going in, man, to election day, not thinking that I'm 10 points up or that I have a chance of pulling this off or, whatever the spin is. I want a really accurate pollster, and I don't want somebody who's going to go out and not poll accurately in my demographic or whatever it is. That's something that's very frustrating to me from a campaign perspective, because you hear all the time, rely on the polls, don't rely on your gut. You got to back it up with facts. And yet you find out some of the facts sometimes are totally skewed, not accurate at all. And I'm sorry, but I don't think Dan Jones is accurate at all. I mean, I think he's off so many times by so many points that I wonder why he's still polling, frankly. But Nate Silver, as it turns out, took a ton of heat. He's out there selling a book, and everybody says he's new, and he's just a hot shot, and he's already said he's in voting for Obama. That makes him not unbiased. And yet, what do you have? He's right on.
But he's also not a pollster.
He's not a pollster.
And isn't that the most amazing thing?
Quinn can speak to this.
Well, he doesn't collect any data on his own. He just aggregates.
He's an aggregator.
And he's got a model that does it. And in fact, all of the political scientists that I've seen that have these models did extremely well.
Yeah.
And part of that is because their models were based on historical trends, and we didn't have an election yesterday that broke with historical trends. And they rely, as election day approaches, they rely increasingly on pre-election polls. Mm-hmm. And it turns out those polls on average, because there's so many of them, on average, they turned out to be dead on.
Right. I think the point Quinn made about the overwhelming bulk of data that's out there available. I mean, at places like Ohio, you get like 4 or 5 or 6 polls a day. It's a big difference than here we have in Utah, where we have the Dan Jones poll and we have our lousy poll, and they were off the mark. I think when you have that much data pointing in a specific direction, even though Kirk said they were surprised by the outcome, I think if you looked at the numbers, You probably shouldn't have been too surprised.
But it's the same thing. I mean, you look at it and you go, I just keep thinking of the Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? The first one where they say they're digging in the wrong spot because they only have part of the map.
Yeah.
When you don't poll cell phones, for example, right, you're going to miss a whole generation of voters now.
I want to shift gears because I want to talk about the so-called Mormon moment. What factor, if any at all, do you think Mormonism really played in the presidential race? Let me ask you. Quinn, I want to get to you, but let me ask you, Robert Gerke, what do you think? It didn't seem like it played much of a role.
I think it played some role in the nomination process.
Yeah.
I think once Governor Romney got the nomination, I don't think it had nearly as much of an effect. I think the point that Quinn made about the sort of the lack of crossover indicates that it may not have benefited him. There were some – I kind of want to look at some of the exit poll numbers in some of the states a little bit more, because it does look like President Obama won the Catholic vote.
Yeah.
And I think he performed – Governor Romney didn't perform as well among evangelicals as Senator McCain did. So I think that may have depressed it some, but I think that's – it's a little premature to tell that right now.
Quinn, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I agree with that. My initial reaction is that Robert's dead on, that it was a much bigger deal in the primary and the nomination phase than it was in the general election. Both candidates downplayed it in every way, and there wasn't a late hit on Mitt Romney's religion that I thought might come from some outside group or something or some anonymous source. You saw a few attempts at this. Andrew Sullivan posted some stuff that was not very friendly.
No, Mormon temple ceremony stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think that got enough or a lot of play in a way that affected anything. And in the end, it still awaits some analysis in terms of And maybe this is something I'll take on with some of my colleagues, and that is what was the effect on turnout? I mean, I think evangelicals that voted ended up voting mostly for Mitt Romney in numbers that maybe not exactly match McCain or other Republican candidates, but probably come close. But I think we didn't see the turnout from Republicans that they needed, and I think we need to get at some ways to figure out if the turnout among evangelicals in particular was down in a close election like this one was enough to really affect the ultimate outcome. I think if they had been really excited about Romney's candidacy, that might have provided us a different election night.
Peggy Fletcher Stack of the Salt Lake Tribune wrote a piece about sort of making the assessment of how this Mormon moment played out. And she quotes a Philip Barlow, chair of Mormon history and culture at Utah State University, who said this in the paper: it developed a thicker skin in the eyes of the world, the church did. Mm-hmm. And the world could see that a Mormon who runs for office isn't by definition a nutcase. So, Holly, let me ask you, is it net loss, net gain for Mormonism?
I think it's a net gain, and I think from my observations, and I'm not a pollster like Quinn or a rock star reporter like Robert, but just that 08 was really the kind of the breakthrough. You know, when JFK ran, he was the first Catholic president, you know, and it was a big deal then. And now it's not an issue. And I don't think it's an issue. I don't think it was a huge issue in this race. I think it's a net gain for the church. I think there's a lot more eyeballs on the LDS church than there have been, you know, nationally, certainly. And I think exactly what you said, that you can run. You don't have to be a nutcase to be LDS, right, and be out there, and we're not, you know, wearing long flowing dresses and, you know, all that stuff. I think it demystified a lot of the religion. And I think the first hit came in 08. And then by the time we got to this one, people just didn't care anymore. I think it's the same with Obama. I don't think people care that he's black. I don't think it's a skin color thing. I don't think it's a religion thing. I think mostly we're moving past those kinds of markers.
We're pretty much out of time, but your blog, Robert, mentioned there's only 1,462 days to Election Day of 2016.
Please fight your
time. Oh, wow.
Right around the corner. Get your lawn signs.
I'm out of here.
How long are people going to wait? Just quickly. You guys have got like 10 seconds before they start talking again about 2016.
I think they started already. I think they've already started talking about who's going to be on the ballot. We're already talking
Hillary Clinton.
There you go.
Yeah.
Hollywood.
January, you'll see campaigns starting to test the waters.
Quinn, final word.
Josh Romney in Utah. Let's wait and see.
Quinn Monson, Robert Gerke, Holly Richardson, Jim DeBacchus, thank you all very much for being with us. Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our theme music written by The Moth and the Flame. Thanks to Taylor Almond. A shout out to our news team who behaved remarkably last night. Thanks very much. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.